time to listen to the interviews from Island Life on Saturday the 13th of June 2015. Island Life is Waiheke Radio's weekly look at Waiheke people, events and issues. It's brought to you every Saturday from 10 to 12 by the Humble Pie Village Butchery. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Oniroa. On Saturday the 13th of June, David Basham spoke to Rhiannon from Waiheke Library about the One Book, One Island project. He spoke with author of The Falconer's Daughter, Ian K. Ashworth, and he caught up with Sarah from the SPCA.
We've got Rhiannon in the studio from the library, and we're going to be talking about a few things. But the other night, was it last week? No, week before, we both attended a book launch.
That's right.
Of The Falconer's Daughter.
Yes, by N.K. Ashworth.
Yes, N.K. Ashworth. We'll keep it secret because she's coming in later today.
Absolutely.
Book launch. Absolute big ups for the library.
Yeah, no, it was heaps of fun and very well attended. We had about 80 people there on the night, which was Chris, the publisher, was very happy with. We were very happy with. Sam was very happy with. So, yeah, it was a big success. And she did extremely well for her first a sort of public appearance promoting her book. It was very entertaining, very insightful. She talked about her journey to writing the book and getting it published, and a little bit about the falconry, which is the underlying theme of the book. So it was really interesting evening. I believe she sold about 43 or so copies on the night, which was brilliant.
Wow, that's really good because, you know, it's not easy to sell books. And really, Chris said to me, to really break even, they had to sell the whole print run.
Yes,
which
that's
was
often
500.
The way. Yeah, often the way.
You know, and he's fairly optimistic.
Yes,
but
absolutely.
He'd put a bit of money into it, even those signs that he had up, which
yes.
were beautiful.
Yes, they were.
They're not cheap.
No, yeah. I mean, I definitely kudos to him. He put the advertising out there and did a really good job promoting it.
And I think the library deserves a really big pat on the back. And librarians turned up, and and you can tell how many people attend the library because they say hello to the librarians and chat to them.
Absolutely,
and it really is a. And there was a good cross section, wasn't there?
There was.
People?
Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
It was a huge success. We were very happy with it, and we really enjoy being able to do events like that to promote writers and. Reading across the island, so that's absolutely cool.
And the library's got that kind of space.
Yeah, it's a lovely venue. Actually, everyone who has an event at the library always comments afterwards what an amazing space it is to have an event in.
Yeah,
so
it feels
it's really good.
It feels booky and without being stuffy.
Yeah, the space is brilliant for.
I was surprised how many people were there.
No, it was great.
Because it was a good and I thought it was well put together and I thought Sam, there we are. We've done it.
We've done it. We've
blown it. Because I know her.
Yes.
Yes. N.K. Ashworth did exceedingly well.
Absolutely. Yes,
for a
she
person
did.
Who claimed to be. As a child, not claimed to be, but said that she as a child was very painfully shy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so you must feel good. And that's in your own time?
We come in to do events like that after hours
But that's
on
your own time?
Yeah.
Yeah, we come in, and I think that's something really, you know, in this day and age to get people to come in and do that. But it does help the library.
Yeah.
Does get more people into the library.
Absolutely. It's all part of it.
And it's all part of it. And I think the library, people are going to see more and more
that
library is a real asset.
In fact, on that note,
yes,
we have an event.
You've got something else to tell
me. We have One Island, One Book coming back this year, which again is a celebration of New Zealand fiction. And each year we select a novel that's come out within the, sort of the last year or so. Previous years, last year we had Sarah Lang. Before that we had Nikki Pellegrino.
Oh, yes.
Yes. And this year we have a first-time novelist. So this is a very interesting novel that we're looking at this year called Vivian's Blog.
Whoa.
Which is by a guy called whose pen name again, I don't actually know his real name, is Stephen Leighton. And he is an Auckland based writer. One Island, One Book, our event is going to be on Thursday, the 27th of August. And we're launching it a little bit earlier than usual this year, partly to give more people a chance to read the book in advance of the event. We'll be putting a display up today, and we've got lots of copies of the book, so come on down to the library and take a copy of Vivian's Blog out in preparation for coming to that event. And One Island, One Book is heaps of fun. The model is a little bit like a combination of an author talk and a book group, because what we do is we have the author come along to the event, and we interview the author, so we get the opportunity to ask questions and talk to the author about their work. And then everyone separates off into groups, discussion groups, to go off and discuss the book and talk about their reaction to it and what they enjoyed about it and what they thought it meant to them. And then after that discussion period, they come back and have the opportunity to ask the author questions. So it's a very interactive, very fun evening, and a great opportunity to really meet the author and talk to them about their work.
I've been to two of them.
Yes.
I went to the one about the was it the Book of Short Stories?
Was that Carl Nixon you're remembering? Or
no.
No. There was also...
was that his daughter?
No.
Who was the woman that wrote the mystery? It was a political one. It was held at Sola.
Oh, the one that was held at Sola was the Sonata for Miriam.
That's right.
That was a novel.
Yeah, that's right. I know. I've just read her short stories.
You've just read her short stories. Yeah,
short stories are very good.
Yeah, Sonata for Miriam was actually, I believe, our first One Island, One Book event. Yeah.
And our storyteller, Supremo.
Yes, Tanya Batt.
She
was the MC.
MC, and I think I was about the only male in the room, as I recall, and she gave me a real runaround. It was incredibly fun.
I think in subsequent years we've had a higher ratio.
Yeah, and then I think I might have been almost the only male with the Pellegrino one, which was
yes,
at
I can
the
understand
artworks,
that,
and that was about. Maria Lanza.
Yes.
That was fabulous.
Yes.
You questioned her beautifully.
Yeah, that was a really fun.
You did a really, really good job.
Yeah, no, that was a fun
evening. But I didn't come to the other one.
Ah, well, Sarah Lang was very popular. And actually, we had a higher ratio of male readers at that event.
Oh,
so you
right.
missed out on that.
Oh, no, I like being in a small number.
Yeah, because the topic, the protagonist of that book was a man.
Right.
And it was one of the themes of the book was architecture. So that brought in some different
right.
people. So Vivian's Blog, let me just tell you a little bit about it. So it's Leighton's first novel, which is described as utterly protagonist driven. Vivian is the apotheosis of the unreliable narrator, which is always fun. I love
Whoa.
Books with unreliable narrators.
Unreliable?
Yes.
Oh,
that means...
I think I'd be an unreliable narrator. I think I'm unreliable
yeah.
full stop.
I think a really good example of an unreliable narrator was one I read some time ago called The Lace Reader, and in the very first sentence she introduces herself and says, makes a comment and then says, but I lie all the time.
Oh.
So you spend the rest of the novel trying to work out what's true and what isn't, and that's a little bit like being a detective. So it's heaps of fun. I enjoy those kind of books.
I tell people that I really like good liars, and people invariably agree with me. But how would you know?
No, exactly.
So I could be lying.
You
then.
Could. You
so
could.
I think I'd be a good one.
So, as I said, Vivian's blog is Stephen's first novel, but he launched it a little while ago in Ponsonby to a crowd of 100 plus people. He is a brilliant lawyer of some 30 years, so you can imagine his legal mind, a very interesting perspective in his writing. Vivian's blog is described as a cryptic masterpiece of chilling suspense. So this is probably our first thriller, I'd say, for One Island, One Book. So again, we're trying something a bit different. It's described as a psychological thriller, writ large, one which takes the reader on a mesmerizing journey into the mind of a gifted, engagingly witty, but disturbingly deceitful woman who uses an encrypted blog to communicate with her ex-lover.
How could that happen? They're not like that, are they?
Well, she is, apparently.
Are we going to have some of them little spring rolls?
I don't know.
They were delicious. They were. That was a nice bit of food.
Are you remembering those from 5 years ago?
No. They were last the other Thursday.
Oh.
Little spring rolls. They were cute.
Yeah, and no, I'd have to say the catering.
We discussed that, a few of us, and we agreed the spring rolls were the second best part.
Oh, okay. Well, no, that was actually courtesy of Chris's own wife. She did the catering for Sam's launch, I believe. Amazing woman.
We may have to bring along our own spring rolls.
We shall see. Yeah, so as you say, One Island, One Book is a ticketed event. It's just $10 per head, and that does go towards the catering and also a donation to the author for coming along and sharing their time with us.
And I've been to two, and I've loved them.
Great. Yes, I've loved them all as well.
The Mario Lanza one was very well put together.
Uh-huh.
You questioned her, you interviewed her. Very good, because she's very bright too.
She
was really bright and breezy.
Yeah,
and same with the other one. Mm. Though I'm not sure we had the one at Solar. I'm not sure we had the.
The format has changed a little bit over the years.
I don't think we had the author for that one.
No. That particular one, she was overseas at the time. So the ideal is that we try to get the author to each one.
But it went very well. Mm. It's really worth going to. I would thoroughly endorse it.
Yes.
I will be there. I couldn't make the last one. I can't remember why, but definitely be at this one because it's just fun.
It's absolutely fun.
And everyone has a laugh and everyone mixes in and you meet people.
Yes.
That's
the thing that makes this particular model so much more engaging than just going to an author talk, because you get that discussion and the interaction, and it's very dynamic.
Mm.
So, yeah, it's heaps of fun.
Are you interviewing her?
Yes, and I
good.
Each year we have an MC. So last year with Sarah Lang, it was Emma Boyer Warner and myself, and we alternated the interview questions. So that was
good.
Yeah, that was heaps of fun. Emma was brilliant, and so I will be looking at organising an MC to work with me for this one as well.
Yeah, it's as I say, I've been to all but one, and I've found them. Yeah,
no, they're
great. I want to really make out to people out there, it is worth it.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Now, the thing that intrigued me when I was sort of putting this together and thinking, I'll come along and I'll talk about N.K. Ashworth's book and One Island, One Book, was that they were both published by independent presses. And that got me thinking because, like many other people, I've been speculating over the past few years about the New Zealand publishing industry and the direction it's likely to take with the popularity of ebooks. And, does the publishing industry have a future? And all of those kind of questions have been kind of milling around in my mind. When I looked at the fact that I was going to be talking about these two authors, both of whom are publishing their first book, and through independent presses, I went, oh, that's kind of interesting. So I just did a little bit of research on that. And actually, I've come to the conclusion that the publishing industry is alive and well at the moment. And so I just wanted to say that N.K. Ashworth's book, The Falconer's Daughter, has been published by RSVP Publishing, and that is run by two people with close connections with Waiheke Island, Stephen Picard and Chris Palmer. And they have done a beautiful job of producing Sam's book. It's very beautifully put together. Their publishing house started in 1990. And yes, it's been very successful. They've published a number of very interesting, beautiful books. And So kudos to them. They've done a really good job. And then Vivian's blog is also published by an independent publishing company called Unoia Publishing. And that was an independent publisher which was formed by a group of writers who chose to produce their own works. Now, you might say that sounds a little bit like self-publishing, which has a bit of a bad rep. But in fact, I can say that one of their publications, Richmond Road, was in the top. It was actually number one on the New Zealand Fiction for Adults in the Nielsen Weekly Bestsellers list just last month.
Wow.
So, in fact, actually, these little independent publishing companies are producing some stunning and very popular books. And then there's also on Waiheke, LaSavia Publishing, which has been launched by Mike Johnson and Layla Lees.
Oh, right.
Which is another beautiful publishing company, and they're producing a number of Mike's works over this year and next year. So really interesting that these little publishing houses are establishing themselves and doing a brilliant job of bringing some interesting and popular works into the public arena.
Oh, Chris is going to come on the air.
Oh, great.
And talk about it. And I thought maybe we could get you in extra time if you got it.
Unfortunately, I won't be able to stay.
Not today.
Morning. Oh, another time.
We'll give you notice.
Yes.
And maybe you can have some questions for him too.
Yeah.
Or
that
we
would
can
be
bring him in your slot, do a little bit, and then have Chris. But he says he's incredibly nervous, and he's not sure whether he's going to be up to it. And I'm not taking no for an answer. but he really wanted to.
Cool.
And, I mean, he sent me an email and I turned up, and you'd think I'd given him the world. I turned up, you know. I mean, it's not like I'm the BBC or anything, but they were so great. They were so gracious.
Yes, yes. No, he's a lovely man. And
They were very gracious. And
yes.
And the author's parents were there, and they must have been very proud.
Yes, I'm sure they were.
They're very quiet people. They don't say much. But I think they were pretty. Because I'm pretty sure I remember seeing the author, N.K. Ashworth.
Oh, yes, well done for remembering.
in the car park behind the shops in Onirua, the day she posted the manuscript off.
Oh, yes.
She
yeah,
doesn't
very
remember
exciting.
That, but she was buzzy. She was
I'm sure
buzzy
she was.
So, you know, it was nice. It
yeah,
was nice
absolutely.
To come along. And it's a lovely book.
It is beautiful, yes.
And it's a lovely cover.
Yeah.
She did say that as an artist, she had her cover rejected.
Yeah, I know. Her original painting.
So there we are.
I think publishers probably do have the right to say that something needs to be a certain way, and it certainly inspired her to create a beautiful cover for them.
I'd like to see the painting.
Oh, yeah, it's beautiful. Mm. Yeah, I have seen the painting. But, yeah, so I think the cover they've ended up with is really good, though.
Because the author of this book bought a house I owned.
Oh, did she?
Because it was so sort of really interesting.
Ah.
But then she sold it and she's moved back up the road to her tower.
Absolutely, her
so
turret.
It's very interesting, the turret and the book and everything. You can see how it all fits.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Is there anything else coming up in the library?
Well, I just want to remind everybody about that One Island, One Book. As I said, it is a ticketed event, but the book is available now for people to read so that they can have a chance to read the book before the event.
Yes, you don't have to buy the book to come along.
You
can borrow it
absolutely.
And read it, and you buy your ticket.
Yeah.
And it pays to get in pretty quickly because
it fill up quite fast, absolutely, And it's, it's heaps of fun. So we're looking forward to that on the 27th of August.
Excellent.
Okay, thank you for having me.
Okay, so next month, I thought maybe we may talk about book clubs.
Oh, yeah.
Might even try and get someone who's in one of the book clubs to come along at the same time and
that would be
say
fun.
What it's like to be in the book club. Because they'll all go, oh, not me, and then they'll come along and we'll never, ever get them away from the microphone. They love it.
I think
the book clubs are, because you've got two, haven't you?
We have, yeah. I run one. Once a month, and Fiona runs one once a month. So, they're both cool.
Yeah, I just didn't have the time with the radio and everything, but it seemed a lot of fun. I went to the one where they used to have glasses of wine. I don't know if that happens.
No, that doesn't happen. So
That was a good one. I can't remember who ran that one.
That would have been the one that I run now.
Oh, was it? Yep. Oh, yes. Yep. That was definitely
bottles of wine
appeared and cheese and crap. Oh, it was a delightful evening.
Yes. No, well, even without the wine, it's a very delightful evening, I have to say. We have heaps of fun.
Well, everyone knows each other.
Yeah, that particular group have been running for some time, though we have had some new members this year, which has been nice too.
Because you read a book in isolation and it's like going visiting something like a museum or something. It's nice to have someone to go, look at that.
And the thing I love about it is that everybody has a slightly different reaction to a book. And, and sometimes those reactions can be very, very different. And that's just so much fun on the book club night to have that discussion.
To show that I pay attention to what you get me to do, you lent me a book from the library or from your vast library, your own library, called Brooklyn.
Yes.
Written by
Colm Tóibín. Yes, an Irish author.
Yeah. I heard him interview on the BBC.
Did you?
Yes, he had a very unhappy childhood.
Yeah, I can imagine.
With the Catholic brothers.
Right.
But he was very interesting.
Yes.
I heard Brooklyn and my eyes lit up.
Yes.
It was really good.
Yeah, no, he's a great writer.
That was a good book.
Yes. Oh, good.
That
I'm
was
glad
a
you
good
enjoyed
book.
It.
I really, really did enjoy it. But
Fantastic.
It was just lovely to hear. I also watched the book show that's on the Arts Channel.
Right.
Yeah. And it's interesting listening to the authors being interviewed.
Absolutely.
Some of them are real hard cases.
All right.
I had the feminist, what's her name, bought the first book out, Australian, lives in England. Oh, she came out here and got a court case for saying a rude word.
Oh, dear.
Now, the most well-known of the feminist writers,
I'm drawing a blank,
really?
Sorry.
Oh, I'm drawing a blank too. I can see her face. She's Australian. And she's been around a long time. And she was interviewed, and I'd never heard much of her. And she was she'd let people know what she thought over the years in various columns and interviews. But she was just charming with this. And it was just fun.
Yes.
Germaine Greer.
Oh, of course. That was the name that had popped into my head.
Yeah,
I was thinking, no, you wouldn't mean her.
Yeah, she was just, she fought her cause.
Absolutely.
And she didn't let anyone off lightly.
No.
But she was in this, I don't know whether it's age, mellowed or what, and this guy interviewed her and they just roared.
Yes.
She was so funny.
Yes, I'm sure.
And people commented on, because often they have asked questions, and they commented on, you seem to have, you know, relaxed a bit. And she went, oh, well, I can still wind up if I have to. But, you know, life gets on a bit. And,
yes.
And, oh, but cool. She was really, really – some of the interviews are very, very clever.
Mm-hmm.
Very good interview with the spy writer, John Le Carrier.
Right.
I was thinking of David Cornwall because that's – I had a boss called David Cornwall, and Cornwall is John Le Carrier's real name.
Ah.
And he explained why he had to be John Le Carrier.
Yes.
Very elegant, very eloquent.
Yes.
Very, very clever man.
Yeah, absolutely.
Very clever. He's and he did two interviews back to back.
Oh, wow.
Though it wasn't long enough. And boy, that's interviewing.
Yeah.
I was thinking of you. I thought, oh, you'd take that one on. That was, you know, that took a lot of doing.
It would have done.
But it's at some big book fair.
Oh, okay. Frankfurt or?
I'm sorry?
The Frankfurt Book Fair?
Another one. It's in England. It's one.
Yeah.
And it does it every year. And they have some amazing people.
Mm-hmm.
And okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's all for this week. So we'll move on. And we've got the SPCA coming in. And so next month we'll have a look at that. And people are to get in and get their ticket to One Island, One Book.
That's right.
And borrow the book.
Cool.
And we'll see you later.
Thank you.
Wakey Radio. I have in the studio an author that I know as N.K. Ashworth, but most of us would know her as Sam. And so when you see Sam walking around Oniroa, that in fact is N.K. Ashworth. And this is her book, The Falconer's Daughter, which Rhiannon talked about glowingly earlier today, and about the launch, which was fantastic. That launch was just brilliant, wasn't it?
Thanks, David.
Yeah, and you did really well.
I was pretty nervous, but yeah.
You did really well for when you said you were nervous. It was not obvious.
Oh, well, that's interesting and how other people perceive you.
Yeah, I know. I always tell people that. People don't know you're nervous. And in any way, you're up there doing it. You're in charge.
I kind of winged it on the night. I took notes, but I didn't actually even have time to look at them because people were shoving books under me to sign.
Yeah. I think you handled it beautifully. It was lovely to see your mum and dad there.
Yeah,
They're quiet, aren't they? They don't say much, but you can see the look on their face. were really, really chuffed.
Yeah, I think they're pretty surprised, actually.
At the number of people.
Yeah.
Oh, it was 80 people. It was a lot.
Yeah, it was.
And you sold it.
I was
it.
Surprised. I went to the loo just beforehand. Right. When I'd gone into the loo, it was about 12 people, came out, and there's this sea of faces, and I'm thinking, oh, my God.
And you sold something like 40 books or something.
Yeah, I think it was 42, 43, something like that.
Did you expect that?
No. In fact, Rhiannon had spoken to Chris, the publisher, and I beforehand and said, don't be disappointed. Often at a launch, not many books are sold. So, we were both pretty taken back, I think.
I think that was a wonderful start.
Yeah, it was good. It was great. Yeah, I mean, and for the publishers too, because Chris had invested so much money in advertising and the lovely big backdrop he'd paid for at Pukeko Design. So.
You told me all about that, and it's not a cheap thing to put the effort in.
And I didn't have to outlay anything.
The
wonderful spread that Chris's wife, Samika, put on.
Oh, I like the little spring rolls.
Ah, right. Yeah, well, they'd all disappeared by the time I'd signed all the books. So I looked and every plate was empty. The joys of being a writer, eh? I mean, I missed out on that.
Yeah, those little spring rolls. They're having One Island, One Book thing at the library later this year, where they have a book and the author, and I've demanded the little spring rolls.
Put in an order, have you?
Okay, so this book, it comes out in how I see it. It comes out of two passions: one of writing and falconry. Tell us about your writing. You started writing in your head when you were quite young.
Yeah, I never thought of it as writing. For me, it was an escape into a fantasy world, and I did it from a very young age. I have vivid memories of walking to and from school as a little kid of just, say, 5 or 6, and I had a stutter, so socially I was very awkward. I was unable to say my own name, which was Nicola, which is what the N in the NK stands for. So as soon as you start a new school, kids ask your name, and it would come out like, nah, 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 and you're sort of labelled a laughing stock from the start. So my solution was to escape into a fantasy world. And in those days, I suppose as a little kid, I was watching things like Tarzan, Doctor Who, Batman, all those sort of things. And so a lot of my stories in my head were those sort of storylines, I guess. And there was always a central hero or heroine that I totally identified with. And of course, in all the stories I made up in my head, I spoke clearly. I didn't stutter. And I would always save the day. Yeah. And I think the wonderful thing about making up fiction like that in your head is that for a kid that feels they have no control in real life, this was something I had total control of. I could change scenes, dialogue whenever I liked. It was like a mini movie playing in my head. And if it was a good story, I would bring it out, you know, a week later, a month later, or a year later, and change it and tweak the end. And yeah, it was. And I never placed any value on this whatsoever. It was my secret. I never told anybody, never shared the stories with anyone.
It was like a coping mechanism.
It was very much a coping mechanism, because I'd sit on my own at lunchtime. I didn't know how to really socialise with other children. I basically didn't know how to play with other kids. For me, playing was an internal thing in my head. And even when my daughter was about 4, no, she was younger, perhaps even 3, and I remember sitting in the car with her and she looked at me one day and just said, "Mummy, you don't know how to play, do you?"
Oh,
and I looked
really?
At her in surprise, you know, really taken back, and I said, "Well, actually, you're right, I don't." And
what
she
an
said,
observant
and she
young
said,
lady.
Yeah, but what came next was even more surprising. She said, "That's okay, Mummy, I'll teach you."
Oh, what bless
and,
her heart.
Yeah, I remember we went down to the play park and there were kids playing tag, and one kid ran up to me and tagged me, and I just froze. Mm. I absolutely froze. It was like I'd gone right back into early childhood, I suppose. I didn't really know what to do. And then suddenly I said, "I don't know what to do." Mm. And the kid said, "That's all right, you're it now. Yeah. Now you have to chase us." And the ice sort of broke. And yeah,
kids
it was,
are amazing.
Yeah, it was certainly having a child enabled me to get over stuff, I suppose, I never thought I would. Yeah.
What a bright young.
Yeah, she always was.
Bright young.
And still is.
Bethany. Mm. Yeah, I know this is about you, but I absolutely, totally, whatever, understand where you were, because so was I.
Oh, right.
I had a stutter.
I didn't know that.
I couldn't say my name. I lived in a fantasy world. My mother was a dressmaker. She made costumes for me. I didn't play with people because they weren't part of my fantasy.
Yeah.
They were not part of it because they were they didn't do it like I did. And I had pirate ones and I had dress up things. And I had all of those things, and I didn't socialize. I was terrified most of the time.
Yeah.
Most of the time I was utterly terrified of what was going on around me. And I made up stuff and dressed up. And when we shifted from Parnell to Grey Lynn, my mother told me to stop it because it just wasn't acceptable.
I suppose
in that kind of era.
On you
yeah. But in Parnell, I lived in a dead end street. Everyone had known me.
Yeah.
And they didn't seem to mind. And I had big backyards and things to do.
Yeah.
And there was no real kids around, but there was when I went to Grey Lynn, and that was quite a different thing.
So did you stop the stories?
Yeah, just stopped them.
Mm. So I continued mine right up till probably even at university, I remember doing it still. So it would be very early 20s I stopped. I guess getting a mortgage, having a job, and also I didn't feel the need to escape. In the same way, because I had I suppose I had the house I'd fantasized about when I was 6 years old. I'd always fantasized, this is in England, on an RAF base. I remember at 6 years old saying to the world in general that I was going to live in a little cottage on an island and I was going to paint. Yeah. That was my fantasy. And by the time I was 20, I had bought that little cottage.
Right. That was the one in...
Wantahata, yeah.
With the little turret.
That's the one, yeah.
Yeah. And so you really did.
Yeah.
I mean, you really did.
Yeah, it was like getting my dream, I suppose. And I suppose that need for story stopped, but I carried on painting. I mean, because I always place value on my painting, never place values on the story making. Until I was 50, and then I had the land slip at the property you used to own.
That's right. I had a major land slip there too.
I remember you telling me that. It must be a weak bank.
I didn't know you could do anything about getting it fixed.
I was really lucky, and the reason was there's a concrete path leading along to the post, which is the washing line, and because there was a concrete path leading to the post for the washing line, it's classed as power to the house. Therefore, that bank at the back, you're still covered. If the path and washing line hadn't been there, it would have been too far away from the house to have been classed for insurance purposes.
When it went further down.
It went straight.
No, but I mean, the actual start of the slip was further down.
No,
it didn't affect the back lawn at all.
This was about a meter from that washing line post.
Oh, right.
And it just, the whole thing, it just disappeared and slid away.
I was given fabulous natives that were very rare, and we planted it all, and it was beautiful. It just totally broke my heart when it all went. I just gave up.
Yeah, well, so you know how I felt. I was gutted because I'd got it really beautiful, spent months, not just months, years of work. Mm. I was absolutely gutted. But I did some sensible things. I rang the Earthquake Commission, the insurance company, and the third phone call was to the Gulf News that very morning. Mm. There'd been an article about a computer in home scheme, and I think from memory there were only a couple of places left on the course.
Oh, and you
and
got
we didn't
that.
Have a computer. And for me, it looking back, it was real synchronicity because I signed up for this course because I knew it was important for Kate to have a computer in the home with high school starting the next year. So it was promoted by the high school. And then I did the fourth thing, which was escape into a story, which I hadn't done in donkey's years. And the story I escaped into and made up was the one called the Griffin Trilogy, which is, of course, central in the in the book, The Falconer's Daughter. Mm-hmm. And the Griffin Trilogy was a pure fantasy about a shapeshifter on Anglesey. And, yeah.
Because that's what I did. I did Robin Hood.
Yeah.
I mean, if you ask me who my childhood hero was, it's Robin Hood.
Yeah.
And it was all those kind of mystical things. And I still drift into those.
Do you?
Yeah, because I'm trying to create one.
Then there's a writer waiting to get out.
Yeah, I'm trying to create one the other day just because things were getting too hard.
Yeah.
And so I was trying to go, if I could only have that place, things would be different, and if I could only do that. And that's how I cope with lots of things.
But it's a wonderful sense. It gives you a wonderful sense of control because you've got the – I mean – you can actually kill characters off. You can bring them back to life if you want, if it's science fiction. You can do absolutely anything you like with your characters.
But mysticism and the whole idea that there's some other world there is just – I just love it.
It's fascinating.
Yeah. I don't talk – here I am. I was saying I don't talk to anyone about it much, and here we're talking on the air telling everybody. Falconry.
Yep.
Where did that come in?
A fantasy. I was standing on my deck in my tower house back in 1988, and a hawk flew over from Church Bay Farm, and I looked up and I had this fantasy of putting up my fist and calling out this hawk's name, and in the fantasy this real life hawk was flying down to my fist. And it was so vivid, the fantasy, that I thought, wow, I'd really like to make that come true. And I hopped on the next ferry and went to town, walked up to the Auckland Library and got every book on falconry. And there weren't many back then, but I brought home every book there was on falconry and just read and read and read and got more books out and did heaps of reading. I realised there was a hell of a lot more to it than what I'd thought, that I'd had a very romantic notion in my head and the reality was going to be a lot of hard work. And I also didn't have any money. I was working part-time. I've always worked part-time, actually. And in those days, I was working for Jane Briscoe at the physio clinic and in Ost End. And so in my spare time, I started gradually making up all my own gear. You needed a glove, hoods, jesses, anklets, all that sort of stuff. And I was very, very lucky. I started corresponding with a guy in Hamilton who'd flown Harriers, but he'd like in New Zealand, but also flown birds overseas in the UK on Air Force bases. And I found out from the Department of Conservation I had to do courses, rehabilitation courses. Back then, there were strict laws over falconry. It wasn't legal in New Zealand unless you used it for rehabilitation with injured hawks. The law has changed in 2010 now. Now you can get a permit just to do practice falconry with harriers. But back then, yeah, it was, put it this way, it was much easier to turn around and have a child. No one checked me out. You know, whereas to fly a hawk, I had my premises checked, my equipment checked. It was very strict. Yeah. It took me a year to finally qualify for my permit, because even having done the rehab course, they then wanted me to go and have 10 days experience with a falconer in New Zealand, which is not easy. It's not common.
No.
But luckily, the guy I'd been corresponding with, he's only a young man in his 20s. He took pity on me and invited me down to Hamilton for two 1 week intervals. And he taught me just so much with hooding, especially when you hood a hawk. It's something you really need to be shown. There's some things that you can't learn from books. And yeah.
And is that the hood goes on them because?
To keep them calm when you're not, say if I was walking up to Church Bay with the hawk and there's cars passing or kids will run up and it can freak a harrier out, especially as harriers are quite nervous birds. And the hood just keeps them calm.
Well, they're a wild bird, aren't they?
Yeah, so yeah. And especially because I was doing rehab work, you don't want to actually tame the bird. You just want to train it. So, yeah, in a sense, that inherent wildness is important because you're going to release it back into the wild. So, yeah. It's where we get the expression hoodwinked.
Oh, right.
They're fooled into thinking day is night.
It's interesting where things come from.
There's so many falconry words that we use now, and you don't realise they're falconry words. Like cadging a ride, you cadge a ride, you get a free ride.
Oh.
A cadge is it's like a wooden frame that a falconer would carry.
Seen one on TV.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And it was
It's like it a chair
big.
Without the middle, in a sense. And
it was big and they carried it along.
Yeah, and you can carry several hawks.
Yeah, I saw them do it. There was this woman who dressed up in appropriate costumes for a time, and she trained somebody with a big line.
Yeah,
and then and the bird would come in and
That's more with a falcon. You can use it with a harrier, but you'd use it more with falcons.
It was just stunning.
The falcon will stoop to a lure, and you train them to stoop by encouraging them to do it with a lure.
I mean, I remember seeing the
There's
big
an
frame.
Real art to fly to using a lure, because the first time you use it, you end up wrapping yourself and the bird all up, you know, in the line.
Yeah, that's what she did. But the woman that was showing her, she was stunningly clever, and they belong.
They make it look so easy when it's done right, but it's not easy. Yeah.
And so how long did you keep that up?
5 years. I guess I had about five birds over a five-year period. Yeah, And then I ended up Church Bay got subdivided.
Yes.
So I didn't have that freedom to walk up onto the farm and it just wasn't realistic anymore. Whereas when I'd flown the birds, there was just Nick and Nettie Johnson's farm up there.
Right.
And Nick gave me permission to wander all over, you know. There's no tarsial roads. And where there's vineyards, it was just open paddock with cows. And the worst thing that could happen is losing a hood and a cow treading on it, basically. You know, you dropped a hood in the field. I'd be keeping an eye on the hawk up above and frantically looking everywhere for the hood.
All right. So then the two things combine. I mean, I'm making it out like there's a linear thing, but there wasn't. But the two things. So,
well, the computer arrived basically.
So after the slip, you started.
I made the story up about the Griffin trilogy, which is all based in the UK. Then I thought, when the computer arrived and my daughter was at school and I was only working part-time, and I sort of thought, oh, I couldn't type. So I thought maybe I should practice typing on this computer. And then I thought, what shall I write? And that's when I kind of made the connection, have story in my head, have computer, we'll write it down. I mean, I joined the dots, basically. And I wrote the Griffin trilogy down. And having done that, I realized I really enjoyed writing. Yeah, it was just enormous fun. And the fact that I got really good feedback too from my daughter, coming home from school wanting to read the next chapter each day. But then I figured that a publisher wouldn't be interested, not a New Zealand publisher, because it was all set in the UK. So I shelved the whole idea for a year, but I carried on still writing. And then a year later, I got this idea that I should have written about a girl on Waiheke who finds an injured hawk, not one on Anglesey, you know. And then I thought, well, hang on, what if the girl on Waiheke finds an injured hawk and also an old manuscript called the Griffin Trilogy? And that's when the dots really started getting joined up and the story came together, and I renamed the whole manuscript The Falconer's Daughter.
And how long did it take you to put it together?
Well, actually, the story about Maddie Prescott, the Waiheke schoolgirl, wrote itself very quickly. I would just imagine the story every night as I was laying in bed, and then get up in the morning if I wasn't working, I would just write it down. And so I think it was over the winter, so I didn't have a lot of work on, and I virtually wrote a chapter a day over a period of a month, because they're quite short chapters.
Yes,
for Maddie in the book. And it just flowed. And I always knew, even when I was painting, when a painting just flowed and it's not hard work, I kind of know it's going to be good. You just had that confidence. When you've got to really work and work and work and rework something, it's like when I'm painting, everything ends up grey. And with writing, it's a similar process, except I'm putting an image in words and not in pictures.
And so how long before you actually had a manuscript that you thought you could do something
with?
Well,
I had that manuscript about at least 2 years ago. But then I got cold feet and thought, I knew it was ready to go to a publisher, but I just felt if I put it out there, I risk rejection. And it was my first novel, and I thought, I was enjoying writing, and I thought, if it's rejected, it could kill it for me, you know?
Fair enough.
So I put off doing that. And then I was scrolling one day, looking up New Zealand publishers, thinking I really should do something about this, and I recognised Chris Palmer's face on RSVP Publishing. And there was, once again, that sense of synchronicity, because he'd been the one estate agent, just as Church Bay was starting to be subdivided, who'd stood at the top of the hill and waved to me when I was flying a hawk. I only knew him by sight. I didn't know him to talk to, but just to wave in the street or whatever, as you do on Waiheke.
Yep.
But I thought, I'll approach him. Yeah. And the rest, as they say, is history. I mean, both him and Stephen Pickard loved the story. And and before I knew it, I was signing a publishing contract.
Right. So you sent it off to them and there was no...
I still had to wait, 8 weeks, which is standard. And, Chris phoned me earlier, actually, and said he loved it, but Stephen hadn't got around to looking at it yet.
Yeah.
And then when Stephen looked at it, I mean, to be honest, Stephen told me afterwards he'd made up his mind after reading three chapters, and he said that was a first for him. Usually he likes to read a whole book, but he'd already made up his mind after the three chapters.
Oh, it's captivating. It really is.
That's lovely.
It really just hooks you in. Yeah. I mean, it's not a book for adults. It's for young adults.
Yeah, it's aimed at young adults, but I'm hoping adults will also read it.
But Chris said he cried.
Yeah.
And I just...
but that's Chris, isn't it?
It's so emotional, though. It is just wonderful.
Yeah. I mean, I actually love books like that. I remember a book I read when I was 12 called I Am David, and every time I read it, there were two places I cried in it. And even when I knew what was coming, I would still cry in those two places. And I remember picking up that book as an adult, ordered it in at Borders, and going and picking it up and sitting there in the Borders cafe.
Yeah.
Sat there and read it. And oh my God, I mean, here I am. I was in my, mid-40s by then, and I still cried in those two places, even though I knew it was coming, you know. And I thought, I actually like books that move me like that.
I think it's wonderful when books move you like that. It's just wonderful. Because it's a real skill to write, to move somebody, you know. That's, I mean, sometimes films can do that, but there's a lot of things going in a film.
Yeah.
But in a book, there's just those words and to get them right. Yeah, it's a
it's
real skill.
It's more like with writing, it's less is more, I think. It's more what you don't say rather than what you do say sometimes.
And how long did it take to get it ready for publication?
Well, I signed the contract probably about this time last year, so it's taken virtually a year to get to this point.
And was there much editing?
Not a hell of a lot. Because my style is quite economical anyway, I mean, Stephen said he didn't have to do a lot. What he did do was really helpful. He suggested a couple of areas where I could elaborate more, which hadn't occurred to me. And so I wrote in a bit more depth about the odd character. It was in the mother's story. I didn't have to change anything in Maddie's story, so it was in the mother's story. And I really enjoyed adding those bits. I mean, usually you're asked to take things out, so it was nice to be told to add something.
Something, you know? In.
I remember always loved that story of J.K. Rowling, because she was told to reduce her manuscript. And she responded by adding.
That's what I would do.
That's what always amused me, you know. But I was actually asked to add, and that and that was great.
You
could
trying to cut things out, I'd be going, no, I'm not doing that.
Yeah, yeah.
Because when you do it yourself, it's your absolute.
I mean, Stephen made the odd suggestion. I think there was a heading of one chapter. I'd done a different heading. I'd put dates and everything in, and he suggested that wasn't necessary. And I was quite adamant, no, I wanted to leave it in. Then I thought about it afterwards and thought, no, he was dead right. It's like you sometimes need an outside opinion, but I'm one of these people that will often give a knee-jerk reaction at the time. Then afterwards, think about it and think, oh, actually, I'm wrong. He's right. And I emailed him back and say, you're absolutely right. And we'll delete that bit. Yeah.
My ex-wife says to me sometimes, I would like your second response to this.
I like that.
She asks for my second response, and she knows well, I know
is
exactly
that Julie,
what
is
she
it?
Yeah, it's
yeah,
Jules,
I can imagine her saying that.
I want your second response.
Oh, she's so perceptive though.
So she can just you know, she knows that the first one's gonna be the second one's gonna be totally reasonable.
Yeah, yeah, no, I'm a bit that way. Well,
it's really interesting. So so really, this has worked along. I mean, if you look at all the time you were making up stories, but in the time that you really worked at it, it's happened quite quickly.
I guess in publishing terms, But, I mean, all that time when I wasn't sending off the manuscript, none of that's wasted. I've actually written other stuff.
Yeah, so I'm just going to ask you that. So, but what did interest me, the cover's lovely, but you had a different cover, didn't you?
Mm. Oh, yeah. Because
the artist got rejected.
Well, that's fascinating, isn't it? I know. Actually, my daughter was far more upset about that than I was. I kind of went with the flow. I was still, like, chuffed that they were going to publish the book.
Yeah, a book's getting published.
Exactly.
Let's not worry.
My daughter was so upset that the painting wasn't accepted. Mm. And the painting is the one described in chapter 18.
Mm.
So in chapter 18, it describes in quite detail this particular painting, which was actually the cover of the book. And I like that idea of a cover being described inside the book.
Then it
an image within an image. But all is not wasted, because I've decided I was going to get those made up as cards. So that image I'll put on cards.
Oh, how lovely.
To sell along with the book, which would be quite a nice idea.
You and Chris obviously had a bit of fun with it, because the interaction between the two of you.
Oh, okay, yeah.
On the night.
We both have a warped sense of humour,
I think.
You
both seem to be able to remember bits you did, and it seemed like it was a pleasant process.
Oh, gosh, yes. Very much so. I mean, it was. Mm. I think it was harder for Stephen at the end, because I probably, with hindsight, had trouble letting go of the manuscript, and every time he'd do a final edit, I'd find something else, just want to change a word here or there, you know, or add a line. And And the thing is, when it's already, they've got the printing quotes in, I mean, it's a sort of a no-no, really. But,
yeah. But you got away with it?
I did. He was so good and so long-suffering, and he did. I think he went along with all the little changes.
But they seemed to treat it with enormous respect, the book, when they talked about it.
Okay, yeah.
That's something I noticed, that they treated it with real respect, like it was a precious commodity for them.
I think... Also, that's why I'm really, really glad I went with a smaller independent publisher, because I don't think you would have that at all if you're dealing with one of the big guys, you know, like Random House or whatever. Yeah.
Well, he's coming in to do an interview with me.
Oh, lovely.
And I'm going to get Rhiannon from the library to come.
Yeah.
Because she talked about publishing today. So we're going to try and do some things.
Cool.
Because when first of all I took on this show, the library slot was 5 minutes.
Yeah.
That's all it was.
Uh-huh.
And now it's like 35 minutes and she has to keep going, I've got to go, because I'll have her here.
Rhiannon's a busy lady.
Yeah. So that's the book, The Falconer's Daughter. Have you written anything, like being the time? Is there anything else that's come up you've decided to write?
Chris, last year, in fact, having signed the publishing contract, he made this throwaway comment about, wouldn't it be nice if there was a sequel? But he said, I don't know if you planned on that. And once again, my knee-jerk reaction was, no, it's a standalone novel. But I went away, thought about it and thought, that's a damn good idea. So I have actually done the first draft of a sequel, but a lot depends on how this one sells, of course. Yeah.
But of course, I don't think there was much, like, there would have been Famous Five and all of those books. And then you jumped in when I was young.
Yeah, they weren't young adults. It was children and adults. Yeah. You're right.
And so these books seem to now be in a series.
Yeah.
You know, there seems to be a series of them.
Often there is. I mean, the sequel is the last one, though. There would only ever be two in that particular story.
Right. But it's still something.
I think for me, I felt that Maddie's story was completed in a sense, but Skylar's, the one in the Griffin trilogy, was left open. And in a sense, Maddie fulfilled Skylar's quest. But there's always that, if I'd been a reader, I'd think, well, what would have happened to Skylar, you know? And so that's sort of explored in the sequel. But Maddie and Jess are 3 years older.
So we could see. So is it written?
Oh, it's all written. It just needs polishing up. So it's at the first draft, so it just needs polishing.
Wow.
Yeah, it's written. So it just, and Chris hasn't read it.
Is there anything else in the pipe?
Yeah, I've written before I even looked at the sequel. I've done one called Draw Me a Hero, which is quite different. Well, it's different or not. Similar style, young adult again, but quite different story. And one called Tunnel Vision I've written, which is set in the Devonport tunnels and a group of kids. That was fun.
See, I used to be utterly taken over by the Famous Five books.
Well, this is five, like, I think it's the kids and the dog, five kids and a dog.
And Devonport was where I used to go as a child to see my grandmother.
I used
to go up the hill, Mount Victoria.
Yeah, and you go in the tunnels.
And so, it's just like that was my big fantasy.
You'll enjoy Tunnel Vision. And I took not only Kate but some of her friends over. And, I mean, it was for the day and put all the kids in the tunnels. And it was fascinating because I'd thought about it or made the story up in my head, but I'd missed things like the way their voices echo.
Yes.
When they're all shouting and yelling at each other and all that. And that was great taking kids there just to get that sort of, you know, authenticity to
it. So there is a bit of work there if things go right.
I mean, I would love just to write.
Yeah.
I mean, to be honest, painting has taken a total back step now. I prefer writing because when I write, it doesn't matter what mistakes I make. I can just go along, press delete or copy and paste. With painting, there's always that element of, what if I screw this up, you know? So it's sort of, in a sense, I'm more free to be totally creative in my writing than even with painting. Painting's very final.
Yes, hard to rub out, isn't
it?
Whereas spell check and all sorts of things and just take that out. And
I mean, there's that lovely quote, how does it go? Creativity is allowing yourself to make mistakes. Mm. Art is knowing which ones to keep.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, that puts a real pressure on, doesn't it?
Oh, no, yeah. I think that's great because I just think, you know, writing on a computer, you are free to make as many mistakes as you like, so you can be totally creative, and then you keep the ones you want to keep.
Right. Well, I thoroughly enjoyed this book, and it's at the local bookshops.
Yep, Take Note, Tivoli, and Ostend Market.
And
I'll be having a store. I've got that written into my publishing contract, which is lovely. Yeah.
And it's a lovely book, and you did sell 40 on the night, which is really good. That shows people are really interested. And it came across really well. Your passion, your total belief and everything came across beautifully. For someone who said at the beginning that you were shy, it didn't come across. It really didn't. It was lovely. If you have to do any more, don't think about it. Just do them.
Do it.
Because you do it perfectly.
Thank you
so
much,
really
David.
No, you really did. And the reading you did was beautiful. That was a perfect bit you picked. I think Chris was very pleased.
Yeah, he didn't know what I was really going to say or come out with, or we hadn't really even discussed. I just said to him, I was picking such and such a chapter, and he didn't even know which chapter that was. Yeah. But I think he just totally trusted I wouldn't. Yeah. You know,
well,
let him down.
You seem to have a really good working relationship with him. He seems very kind and very thoughtful.
Man. Yeah.
And he's terrified of coming on the radio. Absolutely terrified.
He'll
but
be
that's
fine.
Okay. He'll be fine. Now, how do you have a bit particular pattern of writing? I mean, a time or
yeah,
or
I actually
anything?
Worked to quite a system. If I wasn't at work on that day, I would get my daughter off to school and have all my chores done by 9 o'clock, and then I just sat in front of the computer and worked through.
Right.
Usually I'd stop off for a cup of tea and lunch. But, and then I worked right up until she came home from school, and that was it. She took over with the computer then, of course, with homework and things. Sometimes, very occasionally, I'd wake up at 1 a.m, say, and I just had to write something down, which was fatal because then, you know, you're still there at 4 a.m. and then you're dead the next day, you know, which isn't a good idea. Right. But usually I kept to that routine.
So if somebody wanted to start writing, has got some ideas, what is there any?
Just write. It just does. Write. And not judge what you're writing. Just get it down. You can always go back over later. And even if you might be writing absolute crap initially, eventually you go into that state they call the flow when it's just coming. Yeah. And I think if we start overthinking it, you'll think of 100 reasons why you can't write at that moment and put it off.
I know I was driving across the Harbour Bridge thinking one day, I wouldn't mind seeing if I could write something. And I thought, but I got nothing. And in my head, this voice said, what about your great-great-great-grandmother? She came out from England, lived to be 100. And it's an amazing life. She went to San Francisco. She came back to New Zealand. She went to Australia. She did all sorts. And her mother and stepfather released hotels, and they were in the Bay of Islands during the sacking of Kororirika, and it was just stunning.
Yeah.
And it's all there. I've researched it all.
You just got to get it down.
Just got to get it out of my head.
Absolutely.
So just start.
Just do it.
Yeah. Computers do make it easier, don't they?
Absolutely.
Because even writing it out.
Every time you wanted to change something, you had to rewrite everything.
Yeah.
Made a huge difference.
Mind you, if we didn't have computers.
And research is so easy on Google. I mean, I could check up on tides on Anglesey on a certain day of the year. I was on Google Earth researching where things were on Anglesey and stuff. I mean, although I've been to a lot of islands all around UK, funny enough, I never actually visited Anglesey. I'd gone to a number of islands around Wales, but not Anglesey.
Right.
One of my regrets, So thank God for Google Earth.
Amazing. Yeah. Well, thank you for coming in.
It's been an absolute pleasure, David.
And just lovely to And I told you the time would go quickly.
You did. It has.
It does. It goes quickly. Because we also think we had things in common, you know, like the stutter and fantasy. It's not a fantasizing sound. It's just, I love that mysticism thing. Anything with mysticism in it.
It's imagination too. Just escaping into a world of imagination.
My imagination is still as active now as when I was a kid.
And it's ironic that that's the very thing that teachers would tell you off for doing, which was daydreaming.
You know? I was a classic daydreamer.
Yeah.
Hated school. Hated school.
Yeah.
Because
I can relate
to that one. Terrifying.
Yeah.
Terrifying. But, yeah. Well, thank you very much. It's really good and all the very best. Seems like you made a really good start because people warned you, well, you mightn't sell many to begin with, and you started to sell them.
Yeah, good stuff.
And I think the bookshops will probably do well.
Yeah, well, fingers crossed.
Well, they're good bookshops, and they do. Anne is very good in
she's put on a wonderful display.
I heard them discussing it.
Oh, right.
The other day,
what
they were doing. I was in there. And, you know, she's inclined to go, you should read this and hand it to you.
And Liz has put, Liz Eastman from Tivoli has put it in her latest newsletter. She's read it and did a lovely little review. She was very positive. She loved the name Weaver for the Hawk, saying how I'd woven the two stories, mother and
wonderful.
Daughter, together. So
she's
been really positive. She was my lecturer at university back in 1977, 78. Yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So all that feeling of synchronicity,
it all ties up.
Anyway,
well, we look forward to the future, and you seem to have a really auspicious start with lots of, I always think, things where there's synchronicity tells me that things are happening.
It feels meant, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, I feel that too.
And how does your daughter feel about it, having a mum up there doing?
She's pretty proud. She was also very grounding, though, because I remember.
Oh, yeah, you can't be you're not a genius in the eyes of your children.
No. Some a friend once said to me, you'll only ever get a C-minus with your children. No, Kate's good. She she gave me a lot of help, actually, although the cover design is my design.
Yeah.
She helped me with a lot of technical things on the computer because she'd done graphics at school. So, to be honest, it was invaluable help. Yeah.
So she taught you not only how to play, but how to do things on the computer.
Yeah, she totally overtook me with computer knowledge.
You do need them. They're very, that's what we used to say at work when we got stuck. Get a kid.
That's exactly right.
Look, it's just so lovely to have you in, and I've thoroughly enjoyed it, and I do recommend it to people. I really do. It is a lovely, lovely book, and I know it's not an adult book, actually, but I didn't think that when I was reading it, and I just got lost in it. And exciting, because I loved maps and I loved old maps, and I made old maps and pretended they were old, and I had all of that.
Did
kind
you burn
of
all the edges?
Yeah.
I've done that. Been there.
And I used to have all those things and pretend that I was a pirate, and I was a highwayman that didn't do any bad things.
I was the
goodie.
Yeah,
that's where Robin Hood comes in. Thank you very much for coming in,
Sam. It's
been
an absolute pleasure.
That's
thank you, David.
Wonderful. Okay. Thank you.
You're listening to Waiheke Radio, 88.3 and 107.4 FM.
You would have seen her in the local paper. I just realised, you know, I've got to watch myself because she's married to an All Black. I'll you look tough. So here's Sarah, and she's a volunteer at the SPCA. Hello, Sarah.
Hello. Hello.
Yeah, you're right. I'm just trying to get you to come in a bit closer.
Yep.
Because I can see it not coming. That's better. So, SPCA. Oh, by the way, your cat hasn't left home, has it?
Oh, I thought you'd ask me that. No, he hasn't. He's tucked up at home in the bed.
The danger was, of course, if he had it, then I'd had you in tears again.
Yeah.
And I don't really want that because it's not fair.
Me neither.
No. So the cats didn't go away again.
Cat came back and he stayed.
Oh,
he's pretty happy
good on
he
him.
Is. Yeah.
So what's happening with the SPCA?
Well, with the SPCA nationwide, there's been a lot happening with animal welfare issues in the news.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll just start with our little SPCA here on the island.
Yep.
In the last 2 weeks, we have had no cats, which is good news.
No cats, what, bought in?
No cats brought in. No cats in our cages.
None at all.
None at all. So that means that...
How often does that happen?
It happened once, like for about 2 months last year. And this is the first time it's happened this year. For 2 full weeks, we had no cats. So I don't even remember, we went through a lot of kittens.
Wow.
We've managed to rehome all of them.
Oh, that's excellent.
And we now have a couple of cats back in the cages
yep.
that we have been unable to rehome as yet, and a couple of kittens to come back in. But for 2 weeks leading up to this week, no cats, which is good news. We sort of put that down to end of the breeding season, at kitten season, and also that our de-sexing campaigns are maybe having some sort of impact on the island as well.
Well,
so
we
that's
hope that's
really
the
good
case.
News. I mean, we'll always try and find a solution and a happy outcome for an animal before they have to end up in the cages at the SPCA to be rehomed.
Mm.
So it doesn't mean we haven't been dealing with cats coming in. It just means that we've been able to find solutions before they've had to come into the cages.
Right.
And there's been less of them, which is fantastic.
Oh, that's good.
We do have some cats, though, now. We have one young black male, like completely black, super cute. He's very young. He's between sort of 1 to 2 years old. His name is Phantom. He's shy, but once he gets to know you, he's completely smoochy. So he's ready for adoption today, and he is all by himself up at the SPCA. So if you are thinking about getting a cat, I'd pop on up there and check him out.
Oh, Phantom.
Yeah, Phantom.
Oh, he's black and he's cute. Oh, he's male, so he's got to be cute. Yeah. And
so he's probably trouble then too. No.
And, get up there and have a look because, well, if people go in looking for a cat, there's not a lot of competition.
No.
No, so he could be lucky.
I think you've got the best of the bunch there too.
Yeah.
He's out of that kitten phase, but he's still very young.
Yeah.
He'll be ready to go. He's microchipped, de-sexed,
I know. You've got the whole thing there. And he'd be perfect for kids.
I think so.
Because he'd still play around and do things.
Definitely.
Excellent.
We've also got, if you're still looking for a kitten though, we've got two kittens currently in foster care that will be ready in 4 weeks' time, around about 4 weeks' time. So if you have any interest in getting a kitten, just pop up to the SPCA Centre and see Michelle, the centre manager, and just show your interest.
I was interested in that. How does the sort of foster thing work?
Well, it's a pretty casual agreement here on the island. We just put the word out, you know, word of mouth, say we've got kittens coming in. Can someone take them and look after them until they can get to a certain weight where we can actually take them into the vets to get de-sexed and get them ready for adoption? It's a pretty hard job. I've seen some people take home 6, sometimes 7, 9 kittens, and you can imagine how much work that takes,
crazy.
Feeding them every few hours and cleaning up after them.
And you get people to do that?
Yeah,
happily?
And most of the time that person will end up keeping one or two of the kittens.
I know. You wouldn't want to let them go.
No. I fostered last year. I had 2 kittens, but...
You're hard-hearted. You sent them back.
Yeah.
Ah, there we are.
I did.
Hard-hearted Hannah.
Hard
she
work.
Sent them back. Yeah, well, you can't just keep them.
Yeah. It's rewarding too. It's tough to... moment where you bond with these animals and you've looked after them to the point they're ready to go.
Mm.
But if you can get to the point where you can hand them over to, you know, as a good home, it's one of the most rewarding feelings.
Well, you've got to decide that from the beginning, don't you?
Absolutely.
What you're doing. I know my cat would not tolerate another cat. There's no way on earth that she would tolerate it. But I saw a cat in the Gulf News or one of the papers where you put the cat, and I nearly went, I'll have it. But she wouldn't have. She wouldn't have tolerated. But I don't know why I particularly liked that cat. But it was just sitting there looking at the camera, had its name there, and you got names for them, and it's all cute. And adult cats are, a lot of people think just kittens, don't they? But adult cats can be a wonderful wonderful thing to get, because the work's been done, especially if you go to work. Yeah. The work's been done, and they're not going to often harm your couches or your curtains, and they're trained. I adopted an adult cat once, and it was really an absolute treasure.
Yeah, no, they're good. They're low maintenance. They're great. I mean, if you want a furry best buddy like that, click your fingers, low maintenance. They adopt an older cat. Yeah. I mean, there's plenty of them out there.
Yeah.
So the other thing that we have is we have six puppies that we are assisting the owner to rehome.
Oh, good.
So they are ready to go right now.
What kind of puppies?
They are the usual Bitzer. We believe it's all a bit of a guessing game at this stage, but they are like a Staffy Lab cross. So they're small.
They'll be lovely dogs.
Staffy is my sister who lives in Melbourne, where, you know, French bulldogs are all the rage, but they're super expensive, and it's a little bit suspect as to, you know, the breeding of them and how ethical that is. Yeah. But Staffies tend to be the cheaper version.
I had a Staffy.
They're lovely dogs. They're so loyal. They've got great personalities. They're a real family dog. They're low maintenance.
Yeah. Well, this Staffy, he looked fairly fierce. He looked real tough guy. And we had a friend come with her daughter, and her daughter was terrified of dogs. And I mean terrified.
Oh, that's sad.
We get up in the morning, we hear the television on, and there's the Staffy and the little kid lying on the couch together. He just won her over in while she got up to put the TV on.
Oh, cute.
And she was terrified of dogs.
Every kid needs a dog.
Yeah, she was absolutely terrified of them. And her mother was really worried about bringing her up with the dog there. Mm. And, of course, you know what she said then? Oh, can I have a dog, please, mummy? So they're really good dogs. They are. Yeah. So that would be a nice combination.
Yeah, it would be.
But it's a big responsibility.
They are. You've got to be ready for, you know, 18-year commitment.
Yeah.
You've got it, you know, where you're going to be living and how you're going to be keeping that dog. Because one of the big things at the moment in the news, you know, sort of promoted by, you know, the likes of SPCA and SAFE and other welfare organisations, is the change dog awareness. So we don't really want dogs to be going to homes where they're just going to be put onto a chain. It's not illegal. But it's definitely not a happy life for a dog to be living when they're constantly 24 hours a day or most hours of the day on a chain.
People said to me, oh, does your dog stay outside? And I went, no, my dog's inside. It's part of the family.
Yeah.
It's there. I wouldn't have chained my dog up. I wouldn't have dreamed of it.
Yeah.
Oh, that's, yeah, because they do. They. I don't know why some of the people want them.
Yeah.
But it's a big, you know, it's not just, it followed me home, can I keep it?
It is tough. Like, you know, having a dog is a big responsibility. Mm. It's something that can actually enhance your life and be a really amazing part of your family. Mm. But also, if you don't have the time to commit and you're already overburdened with, you know, bills and kids and having to look after everything else, it can become more of a burden to you to have a dog, and the guilt is pretty tough when you can't provide that animal with everything that you know it would need to be happy.
And they do require a lot of looking after, and children go, oh, I'll look after it, I'll do it.
Yeah.
And they don't. Some do.
Yeah.
But some don't. And so that's going to be a big task.
Yeah, I know, because I don't have a dog and I would love to get a dog more than anything, but I know that the situation right now is not quite right for a dog. But if the situation is good for you and you are ready to take home a fur baby, a cute little puppy and you've got the time to commit, pop up to the SPCA again and register your interest with Michelle, the centre manager. Puppies are ready to go. So if you can provide.
But you don't see them when you go up there, do you?
No, you won't. Oh. She'll put them in.
Because that would be disastrous, wouldn't it?
The other thing that's happening up at the SPCA, so we're the only SPCA in New Zealand that has a combined animal centre and op shop all in the one place.
Oh, really? Oh, okay.
Is that we're having a massive bed sale right now.
A bed sale?
Yes, so we've had a lot of donations of beds, so we just want to get them moving.
Yep.
You need something else to sleep on at home.
Yep, beds.
You can get a good bargain on a bed from now until we sell all of them.
Well, you see the cars outside the SPCA when I drive past sometimes, so there's a lot of people seem to come in and look at stuff.
Yeah, there's plenty of stuff up there. We get so much new stock every day.
Yeah, but you've got a manager now doing the – you've got someone who's in charge of the op shop.
Pauline.
Yeah, so that makes
Pauline's the op shop manager. She's fantastic.
But that makes it easier, doesn't it, for the place to run?
Yeah.
You've got someone in charge.
Oh, so much easier. It just means that our animal centre manager, who's also our inspector on the island, can get on with doing what needs to be done when it comes to animal welfare on the island, any of those issues. I don't know if you've heard anything about some of the animal welfare issues around New Zealand in recent weeks. Things like eating live fish at Auckland restaurants.
Yes, I've heard that one the other day.
On Trade Me, the live exports, all these sorts of things. There's been a lot of talk in the news.
And there's been that talk about the greyhounds and live baiting.
Oh, yeah.
But that was in Australia, but they reckon it might happen here.
Yeah. I think the good thing is that there is a lot of debate and discussion happening in the media around animal welfare issues. There are 10 key points and changes that the SPCA wants to take to the government. I can't remember them all off the top of my head, to make changes for animal welfare here in New Zealand and also give the SPCA more power when it comes to intervening in dodgy situations where an animal may be suffering but it's still legal under our government. Good news is we've managed to push through with working with a lot of other organisations, the ban on cosmetic testing on animals here in New Zealand.
Oh, excellent.
So hopefully we'll eventually get...
They don't need to do that. That's not needed.
So we sort of welcomed that announcement from the Minister for Primary Industries the other couple of weeks ago. That's fantastic news, and we'll just keep at it because we would like a complete ban on animal testing across all products and all industries. That would be our ideal situation.
I saw the pictures where they had the animals' eyes pinned open and they dropped stuff in it. I mean...
Oh, it's horrific.
Wouldn't you like to get hold of them and... Give them a good whacking.
Very recently, we've seen the live exports of 50,000 sheep and 3,000 cattle across to Mexico. Not a lot that the SPCA can do about that. All we can do is publicly voice our concerns and take those concerns to the Ministry for Primary Industries and just keep an eye on everything that is unfolding so that we can make changes to stop this happening. We all know it is illegal to be exporting live sheep and cows if they're going over to be slaughtered, but this is under the guise of replenishing stocks for breeding in drought Mexico, which has just experienced major droughts. But we don't know what the truth is. We do know that it is going to cause suffering to those animals as they're transported over. Animals will die and they will suffer. So we're just going to try and keep on top of it. Not a lot we can actually do from where we are, but we are working with a lot of other organisations to keep this in the news and keep people talking about it and hopefully bring about some sort of change in policy. That's pretty much, you know, SPCA's role. You know, we're on the ground. We go out there and we try to keep up the animal welfare and the education in the communities, and we're also working on policy with government and through organisations like Trade Me so that they can actually have a lot more to do and have a lot more action and authority when it comes to dodgy situations. That's my rant.
Right, no, that's my lecture. I think it does start to get people to see the extent of which the SPCA I mean, you do have a lot of influence. I mean, it must be frustrating because there's so many things to be done, but you appear to have quite a big influence.
Yep.
It's just that you, every time you sort of go over one hill, there's another big valley full of trouble and you've got to start again.
Yeah, and it's a gauntlet going through the whole forming policy and taking it to government and making changes on behalf of animals and animal welfare, because there's a lot of confusion happening because we are the inspectorate for the SPCA is actually governed by the Ministry of Primary Industries. So we want to make changes and possibly take complaints and concerns to the people that govern us.
Yeah.
So it's really hard to just have an open conversation and just, you know, without putting our foot in it and actually them stopping us from doing something else. You never know. I don't want to go too much into that. That's politics.
Yeah.
But
you just deal with it.
Yeah, we work hard and there's so much going on behind the doors than what you see just in the shelters.
Yeah, I'm sure there is, yeah. And you're a volunteer, aren't you? You're not a paid...
Yep, so we've got all volunteers. We've got two paid employees at the Waiheke SPCA.
Wow.
And that's just our two managers. The op shop manager, she's just part-time. Well, she's supposed to be part-time.
Yeah, but I bet she's not. But
she's there all the time. Yeah,
but that would probably increase the way that runs. So
absolutely.
It's definitely got an advantage, hasn't it?
That's what we survive off.
Yeah.
That's the only reason we can
be
here.
And it's a lot of money you raise.
Yeah, well, sort of up and down throughout the year. There's so many extra costs because we need to function as our own business to support ourselves and everything. From paying those salaries to the cars to everything.
Yeah.
We have all these wonderful volunteers around who really prop the place up and keep the wheels turning. But to have someone commit, you know, most of their waking hours, we do need to pay at least two people.
Yeah. But it's just amazing, the volunteering just stuns me, the amount of time.
We're always looking for new volunteers. Mm. We cannot ever get enough volunteers to help out in the op shop. So if you've got a spare half a day or a day each week, pop on up to the SPCA and see Pauline at the front desk and sign yourself up and help
us
sort
our
stock out.
It could be a lot of fun too because you're meeting nice people and chatting away
and
sorting things for people. And
it's one of the key things to leading a happy life is having a part in your community and to have a cause and a purpose and be a part of something that's a bit bigger than, you know, you just go to work to make money. This is something you can choose to do to make a difference, really make a difference to animal welfare on Waiheke Island as well. Right. And there's lots of coffee breaks and, cups of tea and, you know, free biscuits and good conversation and maybe a cuddle with
a
cat every now and then.
Drop things in.
And you'll be the first, come across some of the treasures first.
Yeah, that's fairly, fairly quick. I remember a relative of mine got in early one day when some stuff just was being put out and it was French labelled things and she had these Calvin Klein jeans and French shoes.
Nice. Calvin Klein jeans sound pretty good.
Yeah, she got those. She's very proud
90s
of those.
Boyfriend style. We'll be into those. That'd be cool.
Very cool. Well, thank you. Anything else that you want to add? Anything coming up?
No. Oh my goodness. Of course. Yeah, the clincher is that we've just received 100 for microchips and registrations.
Yeah.
So if you want your animal microchipped, and we highly recommend you get the microchipped, come and see us at the SPCA. We have 100 free microchips to give away. So just come up and get one.
So what's involved?
What's involved is you'll have to bring your cat up at some stage. What we'll do is, sorry, I got that wrong. You come up, see Michelle. She will give you a microchip and a docket to take down to our vets, and he'll insert the microchip, which is like, it's pretty much like a ear piercing. It's a teeny tiny, tiny little thing that goes under the skin.
My cat's not been microchipped.
You should get it microchipped.
Yes. I should set an example.
Absolutely. Like the amount of cats that come through the centre that we would just call the owner up and send them on home if they had a microchip is just amazing. And chances are, like, there's a certain percentage of cats that will come into the centre, and because we can't find the owner, the owner won't come and collect them either.
Well,
so we end up with more cats when they actually were already owned, but, you know, they've come in and we can't find the owner.
So
It's worth doing. So please come and see
us. That's really good. So it's been a while since you've been in. Thank you very much for coming in.
You've been listening to the interviews from Island Life, our weekly look at Waiheke people, events and issues, every Saturday morning from 10 till 12, with interviews repeated on Wednesdays at 7 p.m. and Thursdays at 12:30 p.m. Island Life is brought to you by The Village Butchery, the place to go for great cuts of meat and friendly service. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Onirua.